Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 127, I'm joined by Dr. Avnish Deobhakta of the New York Eye and Ear Infirmary in New York City. We discuss several topics, including the association between obstructive sleep apnea and central serous retinopathy. Hey, how are you?
How are you?
Long time. You've been hiding.
Absolutely. I don't think I've been hiding. I've been in the middle of New York City, my friend.
That's hiding amongst
it is, it the is. Only in retina is that hiding.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Avnish Deobhakta. Dr. Deobhakta is assistant professor of ophthalmology at New York Eye and Ear Infirmary of Mount Sinai Hospital, New York City. Dr. Deobhakta, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to talk about the first time we met in a second because it's an interesting story, and we can tie it into sports a little later. But
sure.
You're a new guest, first time on the show. So the question we ask everyone who comes on for the first time is, why did you become an ophthalmologist, and when did you decide?
Sure. So I started thinking about ophthalmology my first year of medical school. So I don't actually come from a family of doctors. Actually, my father is a musician and an architect, and my mom is a teletypist, which just means that she was I wouldn't say a secretarial person, but she sort of worked with making sure trades were affected correctly on the Chicago Board of Trade. And she worked for Merrill Lynch. So I didn't really come from a medical family. So when I came into medical school, I really didn't have an idea of what I wanted to do. And I became kind of really interested in just how much people depended on sight. I actually have very good vision, and I depend on that just like anyone else. And I saw when I would volunteer in the emergency room just how much trauma actually affected the face, and when it affected people's eyes, just how important that sense was to their sense of well-being and their functionality. And then when I delved into kind of the science of it and sort of the way we could kind of help people who were having issues with eye-related conditions, I fell in love with it. I started to do research, particularly in ultrasound, when I was in medical school, and I basically just loved the science behind it as well. So I found something that I really liked clinically and I really liked scientifically. And then once I realized that you could do surgery and you could do microsurgery with all these really cool tools, I was basically sold. So that's why I did ophthalmology specifically. Why retina? I think that the retina for me, one of the things that I actually do miss about generalized medicine is sort of the systemic component of it. I actually really liked internal medicine, and I liked disease processes that affected the entire body. And most of the eye does sort of have that kind of facet to it, whether it's glaucoma or cornea or what have you. But I just thought that retina, just to me, it just appealed to me. I mean, I just loved the structure of the retina, and I love the fact that, you can really see. I mean, it's the only place really that you can see retinal vessels that you can see any blood vessels in vivo. And I thought that was just enormously cool because of the things that you could tell in terms of systemic pathology that a patient had or was suffering from at the time. So for me, that's kind of why I picked retina. And then, it kind of folded in all of my loves of medicine and clinical work, scientific work, as well as, the surgical aspect of it.
And now you're a faculty at the New York Eye and Ear Infirmary. You did your fellowship at Columbia, and that's kind of a joint fellowship. It's not only affiliated with Columbia, it's also affiliated with VRMY, which is a very prominent medical retina group. They also have some surgeons in the group as well, but well-known for Larry Yannuzzi, Bailey Freund, Rick Spade, Yale Fisher. I mean, I'm going to miss someone. There's so many people in that group. Talk a little bit about your practice now. What does a typical week look like for you? What is your involvement in terms of teaching and supervising? And how much are you doing outside of clinical medicine?
Sure. So I actually spend a lot of time with our fellows down at the New York Eye and Ear Infirmary of Mount Sinai. The one thing that people should remember is that New York Eye and Ear has just, is now under the Mount Sinai umbrella. So, and that's relatively new. So I actually deal with a lot of, patients that are coming into Mount Sinai. I actually have a clinic up at Mount Sinai, and And down at New York Eye and Ear, I work with the fellows and in their fellows clinic once a week. And then I actually visit some satellites outside in the outer boroughs. I used to actually go to Queens, and now I actually go to Brooklyn. And we're going to start a telemedicine program in Staten Island, and I'm talking to you from the VA in the Bronx. So it's really funny because I've hit every single borough now, you know, since I've started my job. But it's great. I mean, I think I do a lot of, I rely a lot of, on a lot of my fellows to do, you know, a lot of the, you know, emergency care for the indigent population that comes in through the ER. It's very similar to the way it was when you and I both trained at Bascom Palmer in terms of having, you know, residents and fellows kind of staff the emergency room. But I'm now seeing it kind of from the other side. And, you know, I really value that. I mean, I actually cherish it. I think it's one of the things that brightens my day to interact with my residents and fellows and teach them. For the most part, I do quite a bit of surgery, both with the fellows and by myself. I have almost every day is basically a clinic type day for me, where I see, you know, patients in clinic. I do injections, I do lasers on those days. A lot of sort of medical retina stuff that you would think about, diabetics, macular degeneration, that sort of thing. But also, you know, a huge amount of surgical volume simply because we are one of the, you know, largest referral centers for, you know, emergencies, in the city. And so we tend to deal with a lot of, you know, retinal detachments and that sort of thing, even on, you know, weekends and that sort of thing. So it's very, very, it's a very robust kind of, practice, I'd say.
You know, we're going to skip ahead to one of the topics since you mentioned staffing, and, you've been staffing now, you're 4 years out, I believe, 4.5 almost?
That's correct. I'm almost at 4. I haven't gotten to 4 yet because I started in December of 2014. So I'm almost at 4, but I appreciate you giving me more money.
Giving you a free boost up, yeah.
So, thank you.
So two points, and they're different, and they're from two different perspectives. Things you've learned about how to staff vitreoretinal fellows in the OR, and then what advice do you have for fellows in retrospect now, when you look back in terms of being, you know, being prepared in the OR, but also important things you wish you had understood as a fellow that you understand better now as an attending.
Sure. So I think I actually have one sort of answer to that. I mean, it's not one answer, but I think my number one advice, both for, you know, retrospectively, but also kind of to fellows now, you know, so that is to say the fellows that I'm teaching is basically to not be too dogmatic with the way in which they do things. So, you know, one of the wonderful aspects of our field is that there are so many intelligent people like you and, you know, many other people that both you and I know, both creating and kind of divining inventive strategies to deal with a ton of pathologies. But, you know, sometimes I think that, you know, and I think a lot of the fellows will see this. I think the Mass Eye and Ear course just happened for this year. And that sometimes results in very contrarian opinions about how to approach a given situation. And I think that can become confusing for some incoming learners, but it can also lend itself to a degree of, you know, I don't want to say this word, but I think it's kind of a degree of tribalism that can calcify over time. And I think when we had talked earlier, you had asked me about giving some advice maybe for like left-handed residents or fellows or what have you. And I think I'll actually use that to kind of speak to my broader point that it's kind of helpful. And what I would tell my fellows, and I often do tell my fellows, is, you know, it's helpful to look at every situation from kind of the opposing viewpoint and see the merits of that approach. So, you know, in this case, I guess if you're a right-handed individual, you kind of consider how a left-handed person would think about that situation and vice versa. You know, and I think this is in distinction to some of the other surgeries in our field, which can be sort of somewhat successfully accomplished with a very like specific formulaic kind of paradigm. I think retina surgery is sometimes emblematic of the idea that, you know, the plan we had didn't survive the initial encounter with the enemy kind of situation. You know, so you can enter the eye thinking you're about to fix a quote unquote simple retinal detachment, and suddenly now you're dealing with an evolving vitreous hemorrhage after the placement of infusion, and now that's obscuring your view. And I don't think any amount of just totally formulaic thinking because one guy did it one way will adequately answer that specific circumstance. And really the only way to deal with that is to think, you know, in a broader capacity and kind of have this big toolbox of techniques and approaches that you can grab should you need it. And I think that that's a big thing because we have so many smart people doing so many different things. And I think it can be overwhelming to the incoming learner. I think even more so now than even 4 or 5 years ago when I was a fellow. So that to me is kind of where I go with it. I think, you know, and then on top of that, of course, you always want to know the fundamentals. And I think I've listened to your podcast a lot, Jay, and I think you're right when you say, you know, you have to do everything as well as you possibly can, especially kind of the fundamental aspects of surgery, that sort of thing. But I also, you know, think that people should always remember that, you know, in retina surgery, there's not just one way to do something, right? And understanding that kind of on a fundamental level is actually very, very helpful to kind of approach things when you're by yourself.
Yeah, I think that we've talked a little bit about this. I think that retina is interesting because it's a field where you can do, or surgical field, maybe other fields of surgery like this too, but you can do everything right, quote unquote. You did all the right things. You may not still get the outcome you wanted.
Right.
And sometimes you can do things that would be quote unquote wrong or more cavalier or just not as meticulous, and it doesn't matter. And so I think that, or it doesn't cause any problems. So I think that that leads to a lot of difficulty when you're formulating your surgical kind of basis, because you don't want to fall in the trap of just not doing things because it's easier not to do them, saying, well, it doesn't really matter if I do them or not. But you can also spend too much time doing something. For example, and a TRD, like a diabetic TRD, is a perfect example, right? Like mm-hmm. deciding what needs to be removed, when to remove it, which patient to remove it, how much traction you have to relieve, what pegs need to be, you know, you can spend 4 hours and you can spend 30 minutes in the same eye. And the right answer is somewhere in between on a sliding scale. And the question is, where on that sliding scale? Because we're all kind of type A people. You can end up too invested. And that's not just true for during the surgery, but in terms of mentally, you don't want to be cavalier about your poor outcomes. You want to absorb them. You want to learn from them. But if you let it burden you, then you can really burn out. It can really weigh on you because you're going to have some situations where things don't go as well as you'd like.
You're absolutely right. And I think at the end of the day, like what I'm pointing to is that when you mentioned being on that sliding scale, you know, you have to have the knowledge and sort of the glean that from a variety of different thinkers as to where they end up on that sliding scale, and to understand that perhaps there is a range, and in that range, perhaps falling within that range is the right place to be. But I do kind of hear, and I don't think people actually believe this. I think it's some of it is due to, you know, you're on one side of the argument, someone should be on the other side of the argument, and let's have this debate, and it's going to be great. But I think, you know, it sounds like one person's advocating for one way and only one way, and the other person's advocating for another way. And I mean, the classic example is, you know, scleral buckle vitrectomy, et cetera, et cetera. And who's going to use a scleral buckle and who's not for other types of pathologies. And I think that this is where you get into this kind of, well, I do it this way because I was taught by some people, or I do it this way because I was taught by some people. And it's great to kind of have your own kind of sense of what you would do if you were pushed. But I also think that we do live in an era, right, where there's no longer any excuse to simply just kind of sit around and kind of turn into this like metaphorical, mentally trapped, you know, like stalagmite. You know, there are just too many free and accessible resources out there for which people can learn from, especially around the country, to see different approaches to have an excuse. You know, this podcast is sort of a perfect example of that. But I think that that's where I try to push my fellows, right? I often say, you know, do not be dogmatic, be smart and have your toolbox ready, but don't be dogmatic. Always understand that your approach may be the approach that you're using right now, but certainly understand why other people use their approaches and be ready to use them if you have to.
No, that's good advice. You know, I'm going to say, you're going to be confused when I start this, but maybe you'll figure it out. You know, you are one of the card-carrying members for a, you know, sort of underappreciated and disenfranchised group of the ophthalmology and retina community. They don't get much press. No one really talks about it. But really, the struggles and kind of the difficulties you've overcome being a lefty as a resident and a fellow and training.
Sure.
Not to label you at like Ned Flanders with
no,
your left-handed
store. No, it's really hard for us, Jay.
Store,
I mean, please.
But
no,
talk a little
Jay,
bit, I mean, because we don't talk about this ever, right? So like, what? Talk a bit about if you have fellows or residents who are left-handed who are listening, or, you know, what sort of things do you tell them? I think for retina, it's a little easier, but maybe you're spelling them as phaco when you're training could be really difficult. So talk a little bit about your experiences and like, what sort of things do you think about or appreciate as a lefty who had to learn from right-handed teachers and maybe with right-handed instruments?
Sure. Sure. So I was actually being tongue-in-cheek there. I wanted you to go more and more into, you know, telling everyone how hard my life was and how I've overcome quite a bit, you know, as if I'm like, you know, you should write, you know, arias about me. But no, you know, I agree with you in principle, I guess. I think if you're left-handed, you've dealt with this for a very, very long time. I don't think it's the first time. You know, if you've gotten into retina fellowship, you've gone through a residency, you've gone through life in general, you've probably played sports where, you know, some kind of physical activity you've done where being left-handed makes you different slightly. I will say the one example is that my first three cataracts, I did right-handed because I didn't speak up and say, well, I'm left-handed, and so how could the attending know? I just went ahead and did it right-handed. So the first thing I would tell people to say is to just tell the attending that you're with that you're left-handed, because that helps. How would the attending really know? Then after that, I agree with you that because we're not, again, I think, you know, retina, there's a symmetry to kind of retina, right? Either eye. I mean, I don't, you know, it's not like we just work on left-eyed patients and you work on right eye pathology patients. We all work on both eyes, right? And so sometimes your dominant hand's going to be temporal and sometimes it's not. And you just kind of have to learn how to deal with things. Now, I will say that one of the issues with, being left-handed or not ambidextrous and seeing a right-handed person approach something is that you do have to mirror it, right? And so in some sense, that might be a drawback because you can't just, you know, completely without almost thoughtlessly just follow precisely the way the person's angling their instrument. You kind of, you know, have to think about it. But then again, you have to think about it, which is why I've said that's actually not a bad thing. You just ask more questions, make sure that you understand precisely why it is that, say, a right-handed surgeon, when you see them on iTube or when you see them, let's say, at a conference or you see your attending do it, ask questions as to why they're approaching it a certain way. Oftentimes it can simply be, well, this is just easier for me. But, you know, for you, I would approach it in this angle, let's say for peeling a membrane or what have you. And so I think that the key aspect is to ask questions. On the other hand, on the flip side, I would tell right-handed people, like I said before, think about kind of how another way to do this would exist for you, because at some point, you know, in the opposing eye, this is going to be a little bit more difficult if the nasal bridge is in the way or what have you. So I think that these are the types of thoughts that I tell people. But realistically, honest to God, you have to be pretty good with both hands in our field. And I think that's kind of what I stress. So if I've got a right-handed person who can't retract with their left hand, I tell them, well, today we're going to try to retract a little bit more with our left hand, because what are you going to do when the patient is phakic and you can't cross midline? You know, and so we try to kind of work on these things, right? And the same goes for the left-handed individual, right? So they don't get a free pass because they're left-handed and I am. We've got to work on the other hand as well.
Yeah, and I would add two things. So I was going to say that one of the things, most of our fellows are righty, right? So one of the things I tell them early on is they do their core and they do their trim. And then when they're depressing, I'll be like, look, I want you to look and remember how much more gel you have left on your left-handed side than your right-handed side. And I always tell them, this is not a criticism. This is normal when you're starting. I think for most people when they're training with their less dominant hand, especially in a phakic patient where they're not crossing and they're staying mostly on the same side, whatever hand their left hand is on, they usually leave more gel. And I say it will get better. You will improve at that. But that's what you need to kind of assess, is like how much you're always going to, you're almost always going to get more complete vitrectomy with your dominant hand when you start. That's normal. You have a dominant hand, but to be aware of that, so as you train and as you progress, you're trying to progress evenly and symmetrically so that you don't just think you're fine, but you notice that, okay, I did leave more gel with that hand. Maybe I have to spend a little more time on that side because I know it's not my dominant hand, so I need to be a little more meticulous versus, hey, with my right hand, I'm cruising. And that's, again, true if you're righty or lefty. The other thing I would say is, like, the thing I was thinking about when you're talking was about how to approach things. I think that varies even with hand size. I've seen that. Like, you know, for example, like when I'm putting perfluorocarbonate in an eye, I can do it easily with one hand. But there are people who have smaller hands, and then they weren't able to do it or stabilize their hand. And what I asked, actually, when I was trying to explain it to some of my fellows with smaller hands, I actually went back to my mentors from fellowship who I knew had smaller hands and was asking them what they did. Because, you know, I have never had the experience. I don't have a huge hand. I wear a 7.5 glove, but compared to someone who wears a 6 glove, it's going to be a different experience holding a big syringe or stabilizing your hand. So I think just trying to find, it's never going to be exactly the same as your attending's experience because we don't have the exact same proportions. But that's an excellent point. Look, to just cover something quickly, Avnish, you guys published a recent systemic review and meta-analysis looking at the association between obstructive sleep apnea and central serous retinopathy. Talk a little bit about what this, what you guys looked at, what you found, and then how has this changed how you counsel or approach your CSR patients?
Sure, sure. So the study that we did was a meta-analysis, effectively to determine whether there was an association between obstructive sleep apnea and central serous chorioretinopathy based on, you know, the prevailing literature. And, you know, we did a pretty large sweep of the existing literature within PubMed, and I believe the Cochrane Library and Embase. And we, you know, prior to the end of November 2017, I believe, and we were able to find effectively 15 eligible studies that provided enough evidence and were structured well enough to be included. And the way we, you know, our methodology was to use the, you know, the Oxford Center for Evidence-Based Medicine levels, that criterion to evaluate the type of evidence. And all 15 studies that we used were level 4 evidence, and that effectively means that they were all case-control studies. And then we also used the Newcastle Ottawa scale to assess the quality of the studies, and all 15 were adjudicated to be of high quality. So using that, those 15 eligible studies, in terms of the results, 6 of the studies actually specifically examined the association between CSR and obstructive sleep apnea. And you know, overall, patients with CSR had a 56% increased odds of having LSA. So that was something that we thought was pretty interesting. And then the remaining 9 studies actually examined the association of subfoveal choroidal thickness and OSA. And patients, the most interesting part of that, about that, was that patients with an apnea hypopnea score, which kind of makes people mild, moderate, or severe. So those that had a score that placed them on the moderate or severe scale of obstructive sleep apnea were found to have thinner subfoveal choroidal thicknesses. But we, you know, those two conclusions were actually associated with larger levels of kind of this, you know, of heterogeneity, which, you know, I mean, most people know what this is, but basically which refers to the variation in study outcomes between the studies. So we weren't sure how real that was, but we were, you know, but we reported it. So I think that was interesting. I mean, we thought that was interesting because so many studies had been done on it. So we thought that would be something to present. Now, when you specifically ask about how it changes how I counsel CSR patients, I mean, I think that if there's a patient for whom, you know, OSA is a known part of his or her respective medical history, then certainly we need to be more vigilant for signs of CSR. And I think that maybe is something that people don't even ask about. So I think that maybe is something that people could consider asking about. You know, but I'm still ensuring that I look for classical historical tidbits when I see a patient with CSR. So if you have previous or current steroid use or certain personality subtypes, type A, or a high history of high blood pressure, or, you know, previous pregnancy or any family history, that sort of thing. And then, you know, of course, I adequately image the patient. And so I'm not sure how much you'd want me to get into what I do for CSR, but I think, you know, I think we've kind of added in, you know, if you see someone who's obviously, you know, having, you know, who you think might have obstructive sleep apnea, who's, you know, of, you know, elevated weight and sort of telling you that they've had issues, or maybe you even see it, then that might be something to consider if you're having, you know, recalcitrant subretinal fluid or what have you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is interesting because before I read that paper and preparing for this, I looked that up and saw that and read it, and yeah, I had never really thought about that association. I don't think it was nothing that classically was passed down or taught or was present.
Sure.
So it was an interesting thing to kind of look at. And I think it's a good point for residence fellows or even people thinking of research ideas. You guys took a disease process that's not super well understood and that doesn't have awesome treatment options. It has treatment options, but it's not like a slam dunk treatment option for every patient. And that's where you can look for things and try to elucidate something that maybe we don't fully understand. That's where there's kind of the room to add something useful, which is what
And I mean, I think you're... Yeah, I think you're, you know, I often call that, you know, it's sort of like the research manifold, if you will, right? There's that little distance, right? Like you said, where I think we want to further understand this disease process. I mean, I think CSR is, you know, a lot of us deal with it, right? And I mean, basically, it just delves down into us coming up with a history. Okay, if somebody has a previous history of steroid use, we tell them, you know, to stop, or we counsel for cessation of some offending agent, whether it be stimulants or, you know, even Viagra, I know, has been associated with it. And then, you know, after cessation of those particular medicines, then we kind of watch and hope it goes away. If it doesn't, then we don't have the greatest treatment options for it. So it's very, very good, I think, to understand conditions, or at least try to understand conditions that we have less understanding of at the moment. So I would agree with that.
So I'm going to end by... We always end sports, and you're a sports fan. But I'm going to end by telling you the exact date in time that we met. And this is going to sound creepy, but it's not creepy because there's a
frame of reference. It's not creepy because I think I know the reference.
So we met Monday, September 21st, 2009, in the emergency room of Jackson Hospital.
And
you were
a consult resident.
I was a fourth year applying to ophthalmology on my ER rotation.
Yes, you were.
And the reason I remember the date, I don't remember it. I had to look it up. But I could look it up easily because that evening, it was the longest time of possession for an NFL team in a loss. You remember Do you remember this game?
I remember it. It was the Dolphins and was it the... Minute. You have to tell me who the Dolphins were playing.
Oh, it was the Colts. It was Peyton Manning and the Colts.
Oh, yeah. It was the Colts. Exactly.
The time of possession, I looked this up and confirmed this. It's still the longest in NFL history. The Dolphins had the ball for 45 minutes and 7 seconds and lost.
And I think we were watching
it on a this was pre-tablet, pre-mobile. We were watching it on like someone's computer, like in a grainy video.
Yes.
Oh, no, they were on TVs. They had TVs in the ER.
No, I was going to say, we were doing that to the exclusion of what we were supposed to be doing, I think. But we were definitely watching the game.
Dolphins lost 27-23.
Not very happy. You were not happy.
I was super unhappy. Big-time Dolphins fan. The resident ER was unhappy. He was a big-time Dolphins fan. You had no stake. You just thought it was entertaining.
No, I'm a Bears fan, so I'm just generally unhappy as well.
So what do you want to do? We can talk Bears or Bulls. Do you have a preference? I'm not going to talk baseball, so...
Oh my God, it's up to you. I mean, it's up to you. You go.
I have two questions for you.
Bulls are terrible.
Question one.
Yeah.
Bears, this is a quick question. What's their record going to be this year?
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Not good.
Am I supposed to do it? You know, not good. Not good. The Bears are not going to be... I love the Bears. They're like a religion to me. They're not going to be good. If they are, I'll be happily wrong. Let's put it that way. But I would not bet on my Bears, unfortunately.
And my
what
second
can I
question,
say? Just
my second
honest.
Question for you is Zach LaVine extension, yay or nay?
I don't know. I don't like his defense. I'm sorry. Let me put it to you this way. I think he's just too rich for our blood. I thought they were going to let him go to Sacramento.
Is ever thinking of signing with Sacramento, meaning Sacramento is thinking of signing them, you probably should let them walk because their track record of signing people and having them be good is terrible.
I agree. And I thought we were going to let him walk, to be honest. But then again, we have Garpax, so what can I say?
Yeah, Garpax.
anything.
But Garpax is for people to know. That's Gar Foreman and is it John or Jin? John Paxson, right?
This is John Paxson, the old former player for the Bulls.
Yeah,
who hit the game-winning shot.
Yeah. Former Bull. But they are quietly one of the worst front offices in the NBA. And Chicago Bulls fans know this, but they're in a major market. And they don't really normally talk about how bad they are and how much the fan base wants them gone.
I think that should tell you, I mean, I think realistically only the Cubs, absurdly, and I guess the Blackhawks now are so good, are much better, or historically, though, you know, the Bulls used to be the shining light for us. So that's why they don't really get a lot of flack, but it's not quiet for us. I actually have a friend who does the website for the Chicago Bulls, and you know he has a lot of insider information. But yes, I agree with you. We'll see what happens, though. We'll see what happens.
Well, Avnish, always a pleasure catching up and talking to you. Thanks for coming on
Absolutely.
The program, and hopefully we'll catch up soon. Academy this year? You going to Chicago? Going home?
I won't be because I'm on call, but I definitely will see you at other conferences for sure.
Perfect. Thanks so much for doing this. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com, RETINApodcast.com. All 127 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You can also find our blog, Equal Round Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils, on the website. There are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store and Google Play. You can also find us directly on your mobile on the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at RetinaPodcast. To contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast.com. We really love getting feedback, things we can do better, things we're already doing well, and episode ideas also are very helpful. We appreciate positive reviews people leave in our iTunes Store account as well as Google Play. Many thanks to Dr. Dale Bakta for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here every day. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.